Frank Newton.
I've heard of Frank Newton.
Frank Newton. Frank Newton and old Frank Badishaw were basically horse drivers.
Right.
I think Ned Callard was just a general farm worker, to be honest. And there was others. But these are the main characters. Now, Frank Newton, horse driver, you could always tell him because he had a red spotted handkerchief around his neck. And of course, when they weren't working the fields, they had to cut the hedges with a paring hook. And Douglas, late cousin Douglas, always used to say that if you wanted to know where Ned Callard was, look for a wisp of smoke going up, because he always had a fire going. But those were the three that I remember.
Yeah.
Old Frank was a ploughman and other, whatever horses they had to use, he did. And so was Frank Newton. Now, from what I can gather, when the war ended, I'm going to sort of, it's all mixed up a bit, because when the horses had done their working day in the summer, they were groomed off down here in Debbie and Stuart's kitchen, and they had to walk them all the way up Walls Hill to the top field against the road below the golf course.
Oh, yeah.
That was their summer field.
Right.
And then, of course, next day they had to walk up, because there were no other maids, walk up and fetch them down to do the groom them up and get them harnessed up for that. But there was one guy, and it wasn't either of those two, because they lived just down the road. Yeah. But there was another guy they had that used to drive horses that I think he was up from Luton or somewhere. I don't know how long he worked for grandfather, but he used to walk from Luton to here, probably picked up the horses on his way down, took them down the farm, get them ready for the day's work, walk behind the plough or whatever it was, because there weren't very many implements with seating on, all day long, groom the horses off at the end of the day, take them back up the field, walk all the way back to Luton. Now, because he didn't like the pub up there, or whether he'd been bored from it, I don't know, he would then walk into Timoth to a pub and all the way back again. Can you imagine that? But they were as fit as fleas, of course.
Well, it would be, wouldn't they?
Yeah. But, I mean, there's some of this on this video, that the equipment they had was pretty primitive. Old Frank used to plough, now single furrow, they do about an acre a day.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was ploughing, I had a 3-furrow reversible plough, which wasn't big by modern day standards, of course, by any means, but I could do acre an hour. But he had what we call a balanced plough. Now, it was the forerunner of a reversible flat plough that turns over so that you're turning the ground the same way, whether you're going this way or that.
Right.
And but it was different. It one furrow was up in the air and it was pivoted. So when he got the other end and turned the horses, he could flip the thing over and then come back down, turning the ground the same way, if you get me, because it was left and right hand furrows. And so that's on that bit of film. But there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, the self-binders that they used to produce the sheaves, horses start with, used to have to pull those. They'd have a team. They'd probably have two horses pulling them up down the hill. And if there was any uphill work, they'd have to hitch on either another one or two, because it was a terrible... Old Frank always used to tell me it was a terrible work for the horses, especially on this farm, as being so steep.
Yeah.
And if the cutter bar of the binder choked, the poor horses had to struggle and try and back it up the hill to clear it. But it's all things like that, but they took it in their stride. And of course, the seed drills, the haymaking equipment, all the grass was cut by horse pulled mower and hay turners and horse sweeps, because it was all loose hay. There were no bales in those days.
Yeah.
They used to sweep like a thing with big wooden thing with handles at the back that the horse driver used to hold, and it had wooden tines out with metal point so that it didn't wear too much. And they break up this hay after the horses had raked it into rows to the rick. And then the chap at the back had to struggle and lift the handles up so the point stuck in the ground and it turned over and left the... It's all on that film, if you've not seen it. And turned over, left the big mound of hay there, and then it would right itself and they'd go back again. But then, of course, the ricks, they were all hay ricks. There were no balers in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
They used to have... first of all, they had a grab, which was a big pole that they used to put up with an arm out, which was anchored with guide white ropes. And then they had a rope up round the pulley, and they used a grab. And where the heap of hay was deposited, they'd lower this grab down and they'd push the tines into it, again, sort of manually. And the horse had to pull the rope to lift this up with a great wallage of hay on the back.
Yeah.
They would then swing the arm around and drop it onto the hay rick, which of course then had to be forked around by hand to make the rick.
Yeah.
And the same with them when they cut corn.
Yeah.
I think old Frank used to tell me that he never did any scything of corn except for around the outside of the field. When they went to a new field to cut the corn, Grandfather didn't like, because they had a tractor then to pull the self-binder instead of a horse, he didn't like going round the first round squashing the corn down, because the thing is, cuts on one side.
Yeah.
So, but Uncle Bill, when he took over running it, he used to do that, but then go round the other way, and they cut most of it. But it was all sheaves.
Yeah.
Laid out on the floor from the thing, and then everybody, and I've done this, we had to go round, because we had certain steep bits that we still cut with a binder, even when we had combine, because they didn't like taking the combine on the steep in those days, and you had to make the stooks, because they used to cut the corn not quite ripe, because if it was dead ripe, you'd knock out a lot of the grain and it'd be wasted on the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
So they used to cut it not quite ripe. It would ripen in the stooks, and they, you know, you'd have to go pick up these things, carry one under each arm, and go and put two down, you know, like so, and then another two, and another two, and another two, and maybe one at each end, and depending on the size of the crop, however long you made them. And that had to go, you know, that was done as a matter of course.
Yeah.
And then when it was time to gather it, it all had to be loaded with pitchfork onto a trailer, which in my day was pulled by early tractors, taken, and a rick was made. Now the ricks had to be made properly. They used to put bedding on the floor, faggots of wood and that, to keep it up off the damp ground,
yeah, yeah.
Which obviously attracted the rats. And they'd build the straw rick so that it got wider and wider and wider all the way around. Some were rectangular. I can't remember any round ones, but they were rectangular, so that the water wouldn't run down the side of the rick.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd build the roof up, and then old Frank Battershaw would thatch it. But it wasn't what I would call proper thatching, like you do where you lay it on. It was more or less laid on, but it did keep him waterproof. And I can picture him now up in one of the old barns over there cutting spars to thatch his ricks with.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then of course at some point they had to thrash it out. So originally Grandfather, he bought a thrashing machine, but the steam engine used to come in to power it. And there's film of that happening on this farm video. But latterly Grandfather put up a big barn, one of the original barns over there. He put up a big barn because once they'd open the rick up, they had to keep it dry.
Yeah.
And that meant they'd have to put the thatch back or sheet it down. So once they'd done whatever they wanted to do of it, they would then load the rest up and take it in the barn, so it was all undercover. And they'd bring the thrasher there and do it there. Yeah. But it was all...
So it'd be great if we could get the video and and like sync it up with you telling the story.
Yeah.
Because you'd have all the visuals as well.
Yeah. And that went on for quite some while. I mean, hay was, like I said, in early days was still loose, and they used to have to cut it out with a hay knife. That was, they used to, you know, uncover the, again, the roof was like thatch to keep it dry, and they'd take so much back, and they had this long, I think there's one up in the shed you might want. It's a thing about this long, about this wide, with a point, with a very sharp edge, with a couple of handles.
We've got a lot of old farm equipment in the museum, you know.
And they have to cut it down through and then load that and take it back to the barn. Yeah. Chuck it up in the barn and then feed it down into the hay racks.
We've got quite a lot of implements.
Have you?
Yeah, up on the walls upstairs.
So have I, because the farmhouse where Rhoda is was covered in sort of thing. And it's all up in the shed there.
Yeah.
So that was, and then of course the first thing they did to improve matters, they got a stationary baler, which was parked up, big Fisher Humphreys one, I think it was, again driven by a tractor and a belt, long belt, and we had a more modern tractor hay sweep, and the hay was in rows, as it was termed, and that it was in rows, and you'd sweep up the hay and then take it down to where this big baler thing was, and it had to be chucked up from the ground onto the top of the baler, and that would go through, and you had the thing feeding it down, and the big ram squeezing it up, made ever so big, heavy bales, and originally they had wire on them, but they changed that over to cord, and that's how it was done. And then of course along comes the pickup baler, so towed behind the tractor, and then now it's all room bales.
But the
stuff that, you know, let me just have a look over this a minute. This film of grandfather riding on the self-binder, as they called it, you know, which produced the sheaves, pulled by his eldest son with a Fordson, old early Fordson N tractor with metal wheels. And that's how they did it.
Yeah.
And then of course, in some later life, since I was on the farm, they've had an early towed by a tractor combine.
Yeah.
But it was a bagger. The corn was all put in sacks, 200 weight sacks in those days.
Yeah.
And then they'd be slid down onto a trailer, and we'd have to take them back to the farm and stack them. I mean, those days, 200 weight was the norm.
Yeah.
And they laterally changed it to 3 bushels, which was 100 weight and a half. And now I don't think they're allowed to lift that sort of weight now. But yeah, we used to lug around 200 weight sacks. You put them on your back, carry them up the lofts, the steps, and tip them in the bins up there. You wouldn't believe what we had to do. and then they changed that for a self-propelled combine, and they had an early one and then a later one. And then when that went, we got a bit more modern and had the yellow, what was Clayson combine in those days, and which is now developed into New Holland. Roger's got a New Holland combine, quite a super duper thing, even since I've left the farm, you know. So, you know, things weren't... But it's all we had, you know.
That's great. It's interesting, isn't it?
Because there wasn't anything different to do.
It's interesting.
Other crops that we used to grow, of course, because it was 600 acre farm, because grandfather came to Ash Hill
1917.
Yeah, but what was the acres?
240 acres.
Yeah, 240. Which was like the basis of it. And then he bought, call it what you will, Marner Farm or Redway Farm up over that way. That was another 200. And then in the early 50s, the brothers bought Coombe Farm, which is another 200 odd acres. So that made 640 acres.
That's that over the back, is it? That's like Coombe Way, that area.
Well, down this way, towards Tynmouth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, go up to Headway Cross.
Yeah.
It started, their land started, because they bought it off the Soapers. I don't know if you've come across them. Mm. They farmed up Coombe Valley, Timothcombe Valley.
Right.
And it went down the other side and right up to Exeter Road.
Right.
And so there was a lot of, it was grass because of the nature of the, you know, the field. We used to probably have about 180 acres of cereals, you know, barley, wheat and oats for stock feed, And barley and the wheat were sold off as a grain crop. We used to grow kale, which is like cabbagey stuff for the cows to eat, whether it be beef or dairy. Yeah. We had sheep at the time. We probably had about 200 breeding ewes, and we used to grow four rows of kale and four rows of swedes all across the field so they could graze that during the winter.
Yeah.
But the bulk of it, of course, was down to grass.
Yeah.
Because that's the nature of it. I mean, we used to bale in the early days, the small bales. We probably did about 200,000, 250,000 hay, and maybe a lot of the straw was used as well for either bedding or stock feed. Probably, I don't know, 100,000. It was a lot. But then, of course, we started making silage for the dairy cows. And that was made in a pit where you, we had a forage harvester that cut the grass standing, and it was carted over to Old Walls where the silage pit still is and was filled. I mean, this is not, nothing new. They've been making silage for centuries, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was put in layer upon layer, and we used to put an additive with it to make it ferment right and, you know, keep it rolled down with the heaviest tractor we could find. And that would preserve fodder for the cows. And again, initially we had to cut that out with a thing that looked like a knife, but it was a bit better than that. And then we got a grab that went on the front of the tractor. And it always used to come from over there back to here to start with, to the dairy here. But when we, early Sundays, we scrapped that and we had a new dairy unit down just below where Roger's house is now, big,
right.
Big place there for 100 milking cows.
Right.
And of course silage was taken down there. Still loose, we had to load it in a trailer, and then Max would fork it to the tombstones, because the cows in the winter never went out at all.
No.
There was stalls or cubicles for 100 cows. And we had, it was quite modern at the time, we had a 6x6 herringbone parlour, that's six one side staggered, you know, cows are staggered, and six the other. Bulk milk tank, of course. Tanker used to come 7 o'clock in the morning, pick the milk up. And cake hoppers above. It was all quite civilised then. Not that milking was my forte, but we had to do it. We had to do relief milking because Max and the people that came after him couldn't work 7 days a week. Have you heard of Brian Nicholson, have you?
No, I don't think so.
He was my buddy. He started farming when I did. And he lived down Coombe Way, not where Kate and Wally. Do you know Kate and Wally? He's the window cleaner.
Mm.
The first one you go, the first cottage on the left as you go down,
yeah,
that was owned by a chap called Weber, going back a long way. But the next one, Brian lived in, and the next one again, they are joined, was where old Frank used to live.
Oh, right.
Anyway, so Brian and I used to do the relief milking, but, you know, we'd be, especially in the summer when the cows were out in the field, we'd be getting them in and probably 4:45 in the morning, because we had to get it done for 7 o'clock for the milk lorry to pick up. And once we'd done all the milking and cleared up, Brian had to come back up this end to deal with all his young calves that he was rearing, and I had to get on and feed up everything over the way. So, you know, it was a long stint when you were relief milking, and of course it all started again 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Hard life, eh?
Didn't think nothing of it, to be truthful. So that was that part of it. But yeah, we used to, over here, down here, they started off, because when grandfather came, there was no buildings like there is now. It was just cow buyers, if you like, which he knocked most of them down and put up the brick buildings that are there now. They had South Devon cows to start with, which were what was normally classed as a dual purpose animal, because they would provide milk with a fairly high butter fat, and they were also good for beef as well. So of course all the bull calves went for beef, and then the replacements for the dairy, obviously heifer calves, were kept from the females. And then we swapped over to Ayrshires. You've heard of Ayrshire cattle?
Yeah.
Because again, they gave more milk. And we had to have the whole herd dehorned once, because they were a bit, you know, like this, not to people, but to themselves.
Mm-hmm. So they're the ones that have the big horns?
Yeah, fairly.
Yeah.
And it was the thing to do it then, to have their horns sawed off. The vet obviously did it, and they used to den it, of course, but they looked a bit sick for a few days. And then we gradually switched over to Frisians, and that's what it was. But as soon as I left the farm, whenever that was, the late 80s, Roger got rid of all the cows. He wasn't going to be doing milking, and got rid of all the milking equipment, the whole lot. And I think that's more or less what's happened to most of the farms in the local area. There's not, apart from one big farm up in Luton Way, dairy, I don't think there's any dairy herds around now.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because that's all you used to see in the past, was milking cows.
Yeah.
So that's that. I haven't finished yet. How much longer have you got? Oh, it's early, yeah.
It's early. I just make sure.
Yeah, is your thing going to run out? Or
I don't think so, not unless the battery runs out.
Oh, well, we can deal with that.
Well, we're up to nearly an hour now.
Right. Well, other crops we used to grow, of course, were mangels. Have you heard of mangels?
Yeah.
We used to grow, I don't know, about 20 acres of them for stock feed in the winter. Absolutely useless as a feed, because they're 90% water, but the beef bullocks and the like, and the cows used to eat them. Of course, so again, all done by hand. The kale that we used to grow and the mangels all had to be hoed when the plants came up, because we never had, in those early days, what they now call rubbed seed, because the seeds are in a cluster,
right,
with three or four or five seeds. And of course you put it in the ground and you get four or five or six shoots coming up. Well, you had to single them to one and gap them to 9 inches apart. So the hose were 9 inches. So you used the point and you sort of selected your one, put the edge of the hoe on the ones you didn't want and push them to break them off. And then you'd gap them. We had to hoe about 20 acres of this stuff and mangels. But then they gradually brought in what they call rub seed, which was just a single seed, which all that then you had to do was gap them.
Yeah.
But we used to have a steerage hoe that one of the old hands from down Coombe Farm on his little Fergie used to do. But you had to have somebody on behind on a seat. It had a seat, so you didn't have, and that would get rid of the weeds between the rows.
Right.
It's all a bit primitive by today's standards, but that's how it was. And of course we had, like I said, we had probably 200 odd breeding ewes. Well, everything was hand milked in Granford's day, obviously, and then they gradually got machine milk. In fact, he put, when he had the new complex where what was now called the dairy, that was the milking parlour, and they could milk, I don't know, one, two, probably six at one go.
Right.
So they come across from the shipping, which was just across the yard, into the parlour, they'd be milked, and they could go out the other door, and they would go into a collecting yard until job was done. And then they would walk, in the summer, walk down to the field for eating the grass.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they've covered where the vicarage house is now. There's a big covered yard there. And I think that was put up for them because we tried to get more cows in the shippings in the winter than what it would hold. So I think we had the covered yard to be able to use. Because, you know, it cows out in the winter, they just make such a muck of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were fed accordingly, of course. So that all had to be done. Had milking first, and then after the milking parlour, they fixed up at what we called round the shippen milking, where there's pipeline all the way round the shippens. And you had your, first of all, they had your buckets, which were vacuum controlled to actually milk the cows with the cluster that goes onto the udder. And then the milk was then, if you turn taps up on these pipelines, it would suck the milk out of this churn, and it went down the pipeline into the little dairy. The milk had to be cooled, of course. We had inline coolers and churn coolers, because it was still collected in churns in those days. We used to, you know, I keep telling you that down the bottom there was the old churn stand. Well, that's where to, with a trolley thing, get them down there and lug them up on the top. That's where the lorry used to pick up. Then we built, I suppose it's still there, we built a churn stand just up from the vicarage garage or shed. Is it still there? I suppose it is. And we used to have to pull the churns up there.
Because I used to deliver churns around the village. There was a horse and cart, wasn't there, that delivered churns around the village?
My father and Uncle Ern used to do the milk round. So they do the milk in, cool the milk, because a lot of it was bottled in those days. And they would load up there initially in pony carts. But latterly vans.
I think I've got a photograph of one of those pony carts.
And take milk. They supplied milk to all the village and in Tynmouth.
Yeah, I've got a photograph
of one
of them. And
if people didn't want bottled, they would dip it out with a dipper and fill their jugs up.
It was David Quantick that could remember them coming round with the milk.
In fact, one winter, this is a long time after we'd gone bulk, and the lorry, we had snow, no lorry couldn't get here, and we had the bulk tank, which probably held about 400 or 500 gallon, was full, and cows had to be milked. So we had what we called a temporary tank. It was like a big plastic bag, probably as long as this table and about that wide. And we filled that, and when that was full, we didn't know what to do. So shouldn't have done it really, because it was unpasteurised, but I put it in, it was in the trailer to keep it flat. I went round the village giving it away.
How did you get round the village if it was all under snow?
Well, tractors was all right. But you shouldn't have done it really, because it wasn't pasteurised, but people were quite...
Well, it hadn't been pasteurised for many hundreds of years before that,
no,
had it?
No, no. In fact, I was raised on untreated milk. And when I married Leslie, and I still used to go down and fetch it, made her ill. Because it wasn't, you know, I'd been raised on it.
So
that was that. I mean, we used to have bulls in the early days to service the cows, but eventually that was succeeded by AI, artificial insemination, and you'd ring up, the place was down at Dartington, and you'd ring up, because then you could choose what bulls you wanted for any particular cow, rather than one you had in the bullpen. And you just ring up and kick the cow in, and job was done, like, you know? So that made sure that you could get top quality bulls for your better cows and produce better calves and that.
Yeah.